Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Can I go first with my
Go on.
It's just a very quick one. You're familiar with the work of anti-vaxxing kind of bad-tempered Northern Irish.
End the sentence ending with Ian Brownish, imagine. But go on anyway.
It's going to end with the word
Van Morrison.
So you're familiar with Van Morrison. And you're presumably also familiar with the work of the Daily Mail's regular angry middle-aged man, Richard Littlejohn. These are titles from Van Morrison. Are these titles from Van Morrison's upcoming album, which has the catchy title Latest Record Project? I've got genuine titles there. Or are they headlines from Richard Littlejohn columns of recent months.
Oh, that's ironic. Go on.
Here you go. Okay. Right. Why are you on Facebook? Is that a Richard Littlejohn column or is that a song by Van Morrison?
Well, Richard Littlejohn would have to be au fait with Facebook to do the work he does to some extent. So it can only be the routinely analog Van Morrison digging his heels in. Am I right?
Van Morrison has a song on his new record, Latest Record Project, called Why Are You on Facebook? Can you believe it?
Okay. Least sexy title imaginable.
Here we go.
A rush to hear that, are you? That's brilliant. Go on.
Next one. Old locked down town of Bethlehem. Is that a Richard Littlejohn column? Or is that a song by Van Morrison?
These are terribly good. That's fantastically good. Too spiritual for Van for some reason. Is it? I don't know. I think it's Littlejohn again.
Is Richard Littlejohn. Richard Littlejohn. Okay. No jab, no job. Is that a column by Richard Littlejohn? Or is that a song? A song from Van Morrison's latest record project? What do you think, Alex? No jab, no job.
You know, I'm not going to answer this because I very nearly did one based around Van's album as well this week. So
All right, it's over to you, Mark. No jab, no job.
Well, I assume it's Littlejohn, but this is reminding me slightly. Do you remember the contractual album that Van put out when he tried to get off? I mean, it's just
Van
the same
records.
Thing. And with those terrible titles, you know, just meant to sound as unlovable as possible.
So fantastic. It is Richard. That is a Richard Littlejohn column. Okay, stop bitching, do something. Is that a Richard Littlejohn column or is that Van Morrison? Stop bitching, do something.
I'm going to go for Van.
It's Van. It's stop bitching, do something.
And what is Van doing that's advancing his problems? Yeah,
absolutely.
Sitting grumbling in his back room.
Van is turning back the tide of the pandemic.
I know.
Single-handedly.
That's incredible.
All right, I'm just going to give you two more.
Go on. This is great.
Swampy's kicking up a stink again. Is that Richard Littlejohn or is that Van Morrison?
Too topical for Van. Van would not be sufficiently au fait with current affairs to know who Swampy was. It has to be Littlejohn.
You're right. It's Richard Littlejohn. You're absolutely right. How about They Own the Media? They Own the Media.
That's clearly Van Morrison because everything's a big conspiracy. It's a big conspiracy for him, isn't it? That's brilliant. That's so inspiring.
I missed out. The other Van Morrison ones I got here were The Long Con, Big Lie, Stop Bitching, Dude, and Where Have All the Rebels Gone?
That's good. Every one of them guaranteed to break the ice at parties.
Absolutely.
And get the dancing started. Oh, my God, that's amazing. Well, look, I've got one. It's a big niche.
You're always going to do it, Alex, were you? You looked at the same list as I did, Alex.
I very, very, very nearly did it. So it wouldn't have been anywhere near as good as yours, though. So,
that's very good. Yeah, Alex, do you want to go next? Have you got one?
Yeah, go.
I do. Okay. This is aimed primarily at Dave, because I know how you feel about the popular beat combo Oasis, Dave.
All right.
All right.
So I thought I'd do one. this is Oasis song or children's book title from 2020.
Oh, okay.
Right. Okay.
Sunday Rain.
Sunday Rain. Is that Oasis or a children's book title? It's Oasis.
Must be Oasis.
No, it's not. It's a book by Rosie J. Pover, and apparently it's a lovely tale about having the courage to leap into the unknown to make new friends.
Oh,
okay. Well, we've been sadly fished in already. Go on.
All right, absolutely. Go on.
Okay, Let's All Make Believe.
Let's All Make Believe. Surely that's a children's book.
That's Nolly G. It's it's a B-side to Go Let It Out from 2000, which was Q Magazine's best lost tracks, apparently.
Oh, right, okay.
Okay,
you're
good.
A Quick Peep.
A quick peep.
Is that Manchester's Finest? Children's book?
It's children's book. Alan Oldberg, Janet Oldberg.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's go on.
Actually, an instrumental by Andy Bell, formerly of Ride, from 2002, which is featured on their album Heathen Chemistry.
A quick peep.
Lord.
What a catchy title. Go on.
The Kid Who Came From Space.
The Kid Who Came From Space. Got to be a children's book.
Oasis would not possibly have tackled the idea of science fiction, would they? Isn't that just one remove for them?
You're right. It's a book by Ross Welford, which features a mysterious disappearance, formidable chickens, and a spaceship called Philip.
Very good.
Outside In.
That's Oasis.
It's not. It's a book by Deborah Underwood, which is a comforting reminder that outside will be there for us when we're ready. I'm here outside. I miss you.
Oh,
very nice.
Oh, well, you defeated me there, Sam.
Completely. Very well identified. That's good. Well, look, I've got a quick one. It's quite niche. It's quite niche, but have a crack. Now, some of the admirers of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, a noble gang, which I know, Dave, includes yourself, have long noted that early members often had those magnificent stage names that had echoes of the great British wrestling boom of the 1950s and 1960s, right? The era of giant haystacks and big mamas. Terrible slapstick, cheesy showbiz names with a touch of menace and music hall, all right? So dare you play satirical jazz band Board Treader or Minor Star from the golden age of grappling, okay? or let me boil it down even further, Bonzo or Bruiser, all right? First one, Borneo Fred Munt. Was that a member of the Bonzos, or is that a man you'd find in the ring? Borneo Fred Munt. They're nice, aren't they?
Bonzo.
He's a Bonzo. Yeah. He's a freewheeling jazzer recruited in 64 and immortalised in the intro to the outro as the Wild Man of Borneo. All right, Sydney Big Sid Nichols. Bonzo or Bruiser?
Bruiser.
No, he's another Bonzo. Indefatigably diverting banjo strummer and dodger of onstage cherry bombs in the classic 1965 lineup. There we are. Bulldog Johnson.
Oh, God. A grappler. Wrestler.
He was a grappler. He was a brutal British tight-briefed grappler from the era of Skull Murphy and Catweasel. Do you remember that era? I could just remember it. It's so funny. The wrestling was on the telly.
Saturday afternoon between 4 and 5 before the football results. My dad used to love it.
It was hilarious.
The days of Jackie Palo, Mick McManus. And ideally, somebody would be thrown out of the ring and would land in the lap of a matronly lady wearing a hat.
It was sort of like Hattie Jakes.
Invariably in the front row. We're commentated on by the great Kent Walton, and being brought to you from a municipal baths somewhere in the Midlands or the North.
That's right.
Anyway.
Oh, God, no.
Very good.
Such fun memories. Bronco Wells. Is that a Bonzo or a Bruiser?
That's a Bruiser.
Yeah, tank-like Portsmouth pain inflicted from the 1960s. The man you love to hate, Rhino Slater.
That's got to be the Bonzo.
Yeah, it is. Of course, it is. The full name, Rodney Rhino Desborough Slater, was sax-playing, speech-bubble-toting member of the classic lineup there for all the reunions. Classic Johnny Saint?
Oh, Bonzo.
No, he was a grappler. Grappler from Openshaw. He had the escapology, athleticism, the skill and sheer brilliance to succeed George Kidd as the world lightweight champion.
From Openshaw.
Openshaw. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Count Bartelli. Such a good
wrestler.
He was. Jeffrey Count Bartelli. Fearsome, unforgiving Cheshire-based bone crusher. Famed for wearing a mask.
Yeah, Count Bartelli. Comes from Cheshire.
You see him,
that's all you need to know.
I know, you can see him.
God, it takes
couple
me
more. Anthony Bubbs White.
Bonzo.
Yeah, he was. He was a trouser-filling 22-stone operative of the Brainbiter Guitar, famed for his berserk solos. He later joined Vivian Stanchel's Big Grunt. He was, in fact, built for comfort as not for speed. As Woodhouse would have said, he would have got his money's worth from an I Speak Your Weight machine. All right, one more. Claude Abbo. Claude Abbo. A wrestler or a bonzo? Claude.
Wrestler.
No, he was a sax-playing bonzo. Booted out in 1962. Actually, I'm going to hand it just randomly. I'm going to throw in one more here from my little bit of research here. So, is this a wrestler? Remember the Bonzo? Sir Edward Atoll Oakley, the 7th Baronet of Shrewsbury.
Wrestler.
Yeah, he was. A genuine toff, educated.
Well, it really was.
Yeah, it was.
From
the 1930s wrestler, educated at Clifton College in Sandhurst. He famously drank 11 pints of milk a day to increase his muscle mass. It's just such a bizarre one. Still make a good movie, I think. Don't you think? The world, it probably has done being done. But I mean,
do you remember the days of drinking 11 pints of milk a day was considered the acme of health?
They'd expect you to have a heart attack by Tuesday. Christ almighty.
Can I change the subject? I want to move this on to something that's been concerning me in the last few days. Now, I know, and those of you who are watching this as well as listening will be aware that we are not in our current states ones to point the finger at anybody when it comes to matters of grooming and personal appearance.
Particularly me. I'm going for the backwoodsman look, the log chopper in Portland.
My mother would have sort of looked at us and said, you look like a wild man of Borneo, you know.
Let yourself go. Yeah.
Let yourself go. But it struck me that there's a worrying re-emergence recently of the ponytail. On the tonsure of men who would normally not be seen dead with that kind of thing, because they've obviously not been able to go and have their hair cut for ages. And now, whisper it, my next door neighbor's sporting one at the moment, which I never thought I'd see the day. And I thought Matthew Wright, the TV presenter, had one. I saw it the other day. I thought, this is absolutely extraordinary.
Oh, yeah, it is.
And I've had long hair in my time, but I've never had a ponytail. And so I tweeted about this last night because I thought we could reflect on successful or otherwise versions of the Rock.
Well, there haven't been very many successful ones, have there? Well, I remember trying one once for about 10 minutes at college. One of the people I live with said, wow, that looks good. You look, it's like Jane Eyre. Oh, Christ, this isn't working.
I don't think long hair ever looks better scraped back. The Croydon facelift is not a sensible option for any human being, I don't feel. I can't think of one single example.
No, I just think Bob Weir is a great one. There is only one. Bob Weir, very early on, decided to go for the ponytail. And it worked brilliantly. And he somehow looked even hipper than the rest. And he used to just very subtly remind you that it was a ponytail by always having about 2 foot of kind of loose fringe hanging over his microphone, just to remind you that he hadn't gone short back and sides. But it really suited him. And when he cut his hair and got rid of it, he looked really conventional in the mid-70s. He looked terribly disappointed. He looked like the kind of college jock, killer athletic bloke in a pair of shorts, you know. But Bob Weir, it really worked for.
Bob Weir, no, I agree with you, because I think that, Bob Weir had two things going for him, Bob Weir. One, very handsome man.
Yeah.
Does no harm at all. So whatever he was whatever he was going to, you know, wear, it was going to look fine.
Made up
and
for the rest of the dead.
Two really important point. He had loads of hair.
Yeah.
And
still has.
I mean, ponytail, you can get away with it if you've got lots to put in it. Whereas these the examples that people have sent to me remind us of how people attempted to have ponytails with very little hair. And so Hank McCartney was pointing out Billy Ray Cyrus had a particularly bad ponytail. And Ian Nash reminds me that during the Ghost of Tom Joad tour, whenever that was, Bruce Springsteen had a ponytail. And he never had long enough hair to justify.
He must still wake in the night, bathed in sweat, remembering that.
And Hank McCartney also mentioned Howard Jones had a ponytail.
He did. But you remember the ponytail, that was a kind of little bit at the back. It wasn't a collection of everything at the front that was long enough to go in an elastic band. It was a little tiny thing sticking out at the back, wasn't it? A bit like Michael Jackson used to do. Michael Jackson had all sorts of bizarre arrangements which involved ponytails. But that's not quite the same thing. Yeah.
And somebody else...
Did Prince not have a ponytail?
He did. Absolutely. Somebody has suggested that. Yeah, Neil Christie has suggested that. He says it's successful. I'm not so sure. But anyway, Fraser Elgin says we really should have asked our recent guest, Midge Ure. Because, of course, Midge had a ponytail for quite a while. I'd forgotten until somebody reminded me that George Harrison had one round about the time of
It wasn't a ponytail, it was a top knot, wasn't it? A top knot. Which looked really bizarre. Yeah, it looked absolutely extraordinary. He looked like a kind of a pot plant, didn't he?
Pot plant.
Not successful. I've got to cut in with another. I just remembered Frank Zappa had a ponytail, which suited him really good. It was very much part of that kind of aesthetic of man up at 2 o'clock in the morning, drinking black coffee, not taking drugs, not drinking, handwriting sheet music for his horn arrangements. You know, there was something very kind of dedicated about that. You know, but also on the cover of We're Only In It for the Money, I think he's got bunches. Do you remember that day?
Yes, oh, that's
pretty
true.
Sure he has. The mothers, to emphasise, to italicise what a hideously ungood-looking bunch they were.
Frank Zappa, very striking-looking.
Yeah, he was striking. He was, actually.
Kind of handsome in an odd way.
Yeah, that's true. Actually.
You know, very imposing.
Yeah.
But also, same thing, had lots of hair.
We've missed Mick Fleetwood.
Oh, my
yes,
God.
Yes, he had one, didn't he? God almighty.
Well, I think he still does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Actually, weird. I feel it's kind of acceptable on Mick Fleetwood's head, and I don't know why.
Yeah. Ry Cooder briefly.
Oh, God, yes. He did.
No, the other one was the Ian Craig Marsh, who you and I were talking about the other day, David. Ian Craig Marsh has one on the cover of Pavement and...
Penthouse and Pavement.
But I don't think that's a rock and roll fashion statement. I think that's him... affecting the look of a kind of yuppie, as it would have been then, businessman in the early 80s.
It's close in my memory to Miami Vice. Whereas whenever you got a character wearing a suit with a shirt and an open neck shirt and sporting a ponytail, this was a person not to be trusted. This was, you know...
Oh, God, Francis Rossi. Sorry, I'm getting flashbacks. Francis Rossi, who looked like a sort of Las Vegas croupier.
Yeah.
Or a kind of middling member of the Italian fashion trade, didn't he? Didn't he have a kind of swept-back ponytail for a long time?
Isn't there a character in The Sopranos who has a ponytail? I think the guy who comes from Sicily, really threatening-looking guy, he has a ponytail. No good can come of it,
no.
That's my view, anyway. You've never been tempted to have one, Alex.
I've been given temporary ones by members of the fairer sex, and it's never worked out well for my head. I haven't got the shape of face to be able to sustain that craziness.
Do you mean to say you've had girlfriends or sisters or whatever who have occasionally said, "Oh, let me do your hair"?
Yeah.
I've had that,
and I've just sat there and I've took it.
Yes.
Like an idiot.
My God, it's a plat. What have you done? Mark, I don't know if I have. I did have three sisters. No, that's true. Three elder sisters. It was quite a bit of experiment on my hair in the early days. You're absolutely right. Braids. I'm not sure if I didn't have braids. Willie Nelson, of course, braids. Yes. That's good, isn't it? That's good. And gets away with it totally.
Gets away with it because he's Willie Nelson, and he looks fantastic.
I know.
He's got a face that looks as if it ought to be on Mount Rushmore. So anything you do with his hair is just absolutely fine. You know, he's never going to look embarrassed, is he?
Yeah.
I would suggest that it's the transition to the ponytail that might be the unsettling thing, because thinking about Francis Rossi, actually, when I became aware of Status Quo, Francis Rossi was in his ponytail phase. And whenever I think of him now, that's just part of his head. And when I look at photos of young Francis with his flowing locks, it just seems a bit wrong to me. I think it might be the startling effect of transitioning to the ponytail rather than the ponytail itself.
That's always been my feeling about the wig, the syrup.
The syrup.
You must have heard that before. The syrup. This has always got to be day one, hasn't it? There's got to be a day one where somebody turns up at the pub suddenly with
hair. Hi, guys.
And they've got 10 times more hair than they had yesterday. How does that happen?
Does anybody say anything about it?
Well.
So, if anybody's got any suggestions, if anybody we've missed, what's the email address, Alex?
It is wiye.london@gmail.com.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
We're back. So this week has seen the passing of Chris Barber at the age of, 90?
90. What a significant guy, Chris Barber. Don't you think? I mean, there were two.
They used to say about Alexis Corner, who I believe comes into the story, they used to say about Alexis Corner that he ought to be carried around in a sedan chair for the rest of his life on the basis of what he did for music. Well, precisely. If that was the case with Alexis Corner, it was even more the case with Chris Barber, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I think he's saying, God, I wish I'd met him. I'm so fascinated. Very educated, very middle class, kind of Humphrey Littleton type person.
Yeah.
A kind of theorist and academic. You got the feeling that what he was doing was for the advance of jazz and for music, and it was a pursuit of Dixieland and ragtime and swing and blues and R&B, and not for any particular commercial gain. It was about the evolution of music, you know. And just one tiny little story before we get to the two main things that he achieved was that the story of him and Ken Collier. Ken Collier was, you know, as you remember, well-known trumpet player. Nobody at that stage, the American bands weren't coming over for various reasons to tour. All you could get was the occasional import. There was no information about the kind of jazz going on in New Orleans. Ken Collier joined the Royal Navy in 1951.
Merchant Navy.
And then jumped ship and got as far as New Orleans, where he was there for quite a long time, met up with all these heroes. He joined the George Lewis Band, his great heroes, as a trumpet player, eventually detained, deported, sent home. Incredible interview in Melody Maker, so painting him out as some kind of a returning astronaut, you know, a man who'd been to the moon. He'd actually been and physically met these people whose music was worshipped by all these bands in Britain, you know. And at which point, Chris Barber invited him to join his band and allowed them to change the name to the Ken Collier Jazzmen.
Yes.
Again, incredible example of complete selflessness, because this guy was so key to the holy grail of jazz. But anyway, you know, the two things were, obviously, under the name of the Ken Collier Jazzmen, they could then get those residences in London where they realised that the wind instrument players, you know, just simply cannot sustain constant sets for hours on end, because the lit goes. So they had those little sections in the middle where the three of them is Chris Barber playing string bass and Lonnie Donegan singing and playing guitar, and a washboard player would do their little skiffle sets.
Yeah.
And it was those skiffle sets that proved more popular in the end than the jazz. They recorded a version of Rock Island Line. That was a hit. It started the whole skiffle boom. I mean, it still seems absolutely incredible to me. So everybody, you know, Ronnie Wood, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, Jagger, Martin Carthy, John Renbourn, Ashley Hutchins, Roger Daltrey, Jimmy Page. I mean, just Richie Blackmore, you know, Van Morrison, absolutely everybody got into a band and formed a skiffle group. So that's the first thing he did, is encourage these people to form bands. And then the second thing was that he funded and arranged all these tours to bring over blues musicians to play.
Yeah.
So he brought over Sister Rosetta Tharp, a big Bill Brunsey, Sonny Terry, Brandon McGee, Muddy Waters, all sorts of people in the late 50s and the early 60s, which all those musicians subsequently saw people like the Stones. So not only did he encourage people to form bands, but he then directed them towards blues and R&B, out of which they develop, you know, I suppose you could say beat music and eventually rock music. I mean, you think of that now, that is absolutely unbelievable. Don't you think? It's so significant.
And when I was first getting into music, I was about 10 or 11, trad jazz was the big thing in Britain. You know,
it was.
Acca Bilk, Kenny Ball, Chris Barber, Monty Sunshine, and all these people. So he was always very, very famous, but he was always, he never sported the Acca Bilk bowler he's never quite showbiz.
He wasn't showbiz at all.
He was always very genial. Now, I saw him actually, I think it must have been 2007.
Yeah.
And Nick Lowe put out a record called At My Age.
Yeah.
Nick Lowe, big fan of Chris Barber. And he got Chris Barber to play on one tune, The Other Side of the Coin. And he did a show at St. Luke's in Old Street for the BBC, I think it must have been. So it's probably on YouTube or on the BBC iPlayer or whatever, with a small band. And Chris Barber was there in the back line. So it's very, very nice to see him. So heck of an innings.
What an innings. I discovered an amazing recording of Cat Call, which is an old Paul McCartney song that the Beatles used to do. It's a kind of instrumental band in about 1961, recorded in with McCartney there and stuff in 1967, which is phenomenal. Really worth hearing. It's on YouTube. But that whole era I find fascinating. Also, I find Rock Island Line being a hit is so fascinating because it's about a world that nobody had any comprehension of. It's about freight trains. It's about toll gates. You know, it's
the book that sums up all this, you know, for anybody who hasn't read it already, is Billy Bragg's excellent,
fabulous
book about skiffle. What's it called? Rock Roots and Skiffle, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Billy Bragg's book about skiffle, and Billy was a guest of ours on. Came to the Islington a few years ago to talk about that. It's a terrific. Look, if anybody wants to get a window on that particular world.
But the other person we ought to mention, Bunny Wailer, too. I think that's Bunny a story. Wailer. Because I don't know if you, or maybe you do, but I'm never quite sure how Bunny Wailer felt about the way it all worked out. Because the Bunny Wailer story, he met Bob Marley at school when he was about six. They were both children of single-parent families, and eventually Bunny Wailer's father had a daughter with Bob Marley's mum. So they had a sister. I mean, this is very, very Jamaican, in the same way that Peter Tosh had a son with Bunny Wailer's sister. I mean, it all gets very complicated. But anyway, they were huge mates. And then there's one I've read so much about that particular period of the Wailing Wailers, and how he and Marley and Peter Tosh used to go off into graveyards at night. They'd break into graveyards and to try and freak themselves out with the duppy spirits and practice singing their harmonies, you know. And then they had some hits as the Wailing Wailers, Simmer Down, you know, the Cox and Dodd production. Yeah, yeah. And then there's that period that nobody ever really mentions when Marley actually gave up, didn't he? He went to Delaware. His mum moved to Delaware. He moved to Delaware and then got a job in a factory. And, you know, Bunny and Peter Tosh kept going and put out records with that. And when he came back, they reformed. Then they signed to Ireland with Chris Blackwell, Catch a Fire. And then there's two things seemed to happen, which is that Bunny and Peter Tosh said they were leaving. And they said, suppose they were leaving because playing in various clubs didn't somehow agree with their Rastafarian principles or whatever. But the other thing was that Blackwell wanted to market the group, didn't he, as a kind of rock band, really. Quite rightly, just big, heavy rhythm section with electric guitar solos.
Yeah.
And that kind of put those guys onto the back burner. So whether or not they felt they were being eased out and left, or whether or not they really wanted to go and he then took advantage of it, I don't really know. So you can't tell whether he was... Bunny Wailer went on to make some good records afterwards. Carried on recording and had some success, but very much, very much kind of...
Nothing like up in the woods,
smoking the herb, wasn't it? Marley was the kind of global evangelist for reggae and for Rastafari, and Tosh was the kind of militant conscience And Bunny was the kind of spiritual ambassador. And actually, Marley took over all three of those things really successfully. Yeah. Marley then became the militant conscience as well. Get up, stand up. You know, didn't he? Manly and Sieger at the One Love concert. And he became the spiritual ambassador, you know, natural mystic and the religious side of it and the herbs. So he took over all three things brilliantly. And I can still remember an interview where in the NME where they changed the name of the group to Bob Marley and the Wailers. He was driving a BMW and he was being accused of suddenly getting huge amounts of record company advice. He said it was BMW, Bob Marley and the Wailers. That was his excuse.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, I mean, you don't
know. He used to also say Black Man's Wheels, didn't he?
Black Man's Wheels. Black Man's Wheels, that's it. But you don't know whether Bunny, did he die, you know, aggrieved and resentful and bitter? I really have no idea. Absolutely no idea.
Well, all musicians are aggrieved, bitter and resentful, aren't they, Alex? Isn't that true? pretty much everyone that I've met. Is that true?
Highly strung.
Hey, is there an example of a musician who doesn't feel that they could have got more success and credibility than they've already got, no matter how much they've got?
Johnny Marr.
I always think, Johnny Marr, do you think so?
I'd argue, yeah, he seems like absolutely at peace with everything, to me at least.
Right.
He seems to me like the kind of like a person who's achieved everything they could possibly want to achieve, is in it absolutely for the art.
Yeah.
Completely happy with their journey, hasn't messed up once, you know?
Never put a foot wrong, that's true.
He's kind of had the perfect career trajectory, you know, and he seems like he's completely happy with everything, and he accepts everything as well, you know. He's not, he doesn't seem bitter about Morrissey or the Smiths, or the way that ended and the relationships kind of went, you know. I think they do exist out there.
Now's a good time to introduce the person who we always say is the person who won rock and roll if it was a contest, who is Robert Fripp, of course, because again, Robert Fripp's done what Robert Fripp wanted to do since he was in his 20s and continues to do it very, very successfully to this day. And furthermore, it's only this week that it was brought to my attention
that
Robert Fripp will also do you a birthday greeting if you want one and you're disposed to pay whatever it costs.
£80. It's 80 quid. I thought that was a genius idea.
Is that all it is?
It's 80 quid. Because I thought it was a genius idea because before, presumably, if you wanted to get someone, you'd have to go through the press person to get hold of the management to say, terrific favour for my husband, Steve, it's his 60th birthday, he's bought every one of your records, could you come? And therefore, the person who does it is doing it, I mean, I don't know about grudging, but it's certainly a favour. But if you say, I tell you what, 80 quid, you know, and Robert Fripp, of course, does it with no cynicism. He's so upbeat, sincere, so sweet. There's a lovely bit where the guy does this recording. I've seen one of them, and the guy says, could you play this particular lick for me on your guitar? So he said, well, I can't actually play it on the guitar. I'll show you the guitar that I recorded it on, you know. So it's that idea that you could get Robert Fripp to record you. He could probably end domestic disputes. You could probably get Robert Fripp to record an encouraging message about how you ought to do more hoovering or shopping or help with the cleaning around the house. Yes.
And if
Robert Fripp says it's a good idea, then I might do it, you know.
You could write a song called Put the Bins Out. It's Put Monday night, it's bins time.
Recycle tomorrow.
Is he doing that through his own platform, or is he?
I think he's doing it through one of these organisations that, I'm trying to find it.
Because there's a platform called Cameo.
It's one of those kind of things.
Yeah,
David Hasselhoff is doing it, and you know, it seems like it's quite.
It made me wonder if people are still doing those. Still doing. Do you remember there was a time when and Ian McNabb of the Icicle Works was the first person I heard of doing this, and you could get him to go around to your house. I think Glenn from Squeeze was doing it too. If it's your birthday or something, he would go around to your house and put on a special show in your living room with the 10 songs you most wanted to hear, and which sounded absolutely fantastic. So a curtain would be pulled back, and there would be Ian McNabb and acoustic guitar about to do Love is a Wonderful Colour, you know. And I just wondered if people are still doing those things digitally. Are they preparing a perfect Zoom show, which you could then show to your other half or whatever? Maybe they are, I don't know.
That's Robert Fripp there. It's on a site called Celeb. VM, Celebrity Video Messages.
Oh, right.
Celeb BVM. celebvm.com. People can find it. And there's loads of people, and Robert Fripp is one of them. So, you know, that you would never have had a bet on that. 40
no, you wouldn't.
Who do you think? Who do you think will be doing or knocking out the birthday messages? You know, in his 70s?
And he's so kind of personable. There he is in his three-piece tweed suit. You know, yes. He's so sincere and lovely.
But
what
also,
a great man!
It kind of goes to show that we're moving from an economy of that's based around art into an economy that's based around connection. That's the interesting thing. It was
probably a good time to bring up that thing that you were pointing out to us earlier in the week, which is the new music from The Kings of Leon.
Go on. Now, what's happening there?
So the Kings of Leon are releasing a new record. And they're releasing it as what's called a non-fungible token.
Catchy.
Which is
sexy. Yeah.
It'll catch
sounds organic.
So this is a kind of cryptocurrency, basically. And it's kind of like a digital gold bar in the sense that... So there are two types of cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency obviously is digital money, effectively. It has its own value. It fluctuates like the stock markets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are two types. There's the fungible type, which is spendable. So, you know, you buy your cryptocurrency and you spend it on something else. And there is non-fungible, which are kind of like gold bars, which kind of retain their value, kind of go up in value, down in value.
Stay in the world. They stay in the world that they came from.
Yeah,
they never transfer to the real world. Okay, right, go on.
So what they're doing, they're releasing this new album as a non-fungible token. And it's going to be available for 2 weeks. It's going to cost $50. And what you will get for that $50 is your non-fungible token, which will consist of a download of the record, exclusive moving artwork, whatever that means, and access to limited edition vinyl. Once that two-week period is up, the product won't be available anymore outside of the people who have already bought it, who can then choose to sell it off at a price that they choose to let it go at. So it's a bit like, I suppose, it becomes a collectible item that can be passed on like rare vinyl, you know, for whatever price the buyer is prepared to pay. It's a tradable collectible, essentially. There are a few artists which have sort of jumped on that bandwagon over recent months. It seems to be gaining some momentum. So Grimes has been selling her artwork via crypto, and she's made about $6 million from it. But it's this huge complex computer network, basically, and it creates this massive carbon footprint. So what's the name of the... So it's done by Ethereum, which is a type of cryptocurrency. There are different types of cryptocurrency. And apparently Ethereum's yearly carbon footprint just to produce these kind of coins and tokens, which they have to mine using computer power for. Ethereum's yearly carbon footprint is bigger than Argentina's. It's insane. Each coin, if you like, has to be mined by a complex computer network. And there is apparently a limit to the amount that can be mined based on the power available. You've got miners in Russia that have set up these warehouse-sized rigs that attach to hydroelectric power stations. That's how much juice it takes to run that industry. It's absolutely insane. But
to put out a Grimes record.
Put out a Grimes record or the new KOL masterpiece. Yeah,
but the new KOL masterpiece, as you refer to it, will still be available in its traditional forms. So you could download, you could stream it from Spotify, and you could go probably buy a CD as well. I think you can do that as well. But this is just I thought from my reading of it, I thought you could. Maybe I'm wrong.
Know.
The oddest thing about this is also that the idea you're being encouraged to buy a record and then make money out of it by selling it on. Don't you think?
Yeah. Well, it does seem like, it seems a bit like ticket touting, you know. It's like, you know, who gets cup final tickets? Well, you know, the touts will get a certain number of them and they'll, you know, pass them on for a fortune.
Well, what they're also doing is that they're mining a limited, I think it's 18 golden tickets, and they're going to auction 6 of them, and they're going to vault 12 of them, just like... just like you would with a rare piece of art from a collection. And so these golden tickets encompass like front row concert seats on any Kings of Leon tour for the rest of your life. Backstage access, lounge access, a driver, a car full of goodies, the whole shebang. Obviously, you know, it's quite significantly more expensive than $50, but we're sort of leveraging kind of the experiential aspect of things there as well. But again, it's completely limited edition, available for a limited time only.
That was going on already, wasn't it, with those gold circle tickets? You could buy a package, couldn't you, go and see Rolling Stones or something? You had a $100 ticket, or you could buy a, I don't know, $500 ticket that was right, quite near the front door, or £2,000, you got a bit of smoked salmon and a glass of white, and you got to have your photograph taken with Ronnie Wood or whatever. There's various degrees, weren't there? You got to meet the band.
Yeah. I think. I wonder, though, if this is taking the value away from the actual album itself, you know, and turning...
It must be.
It's
got to be.
Yeah.
It's got to be. See, tell me, here's something that went through my head in the last week. In the last year, there have been far fewer record releases, presumably. I'm guessing. There must have been. Yes?
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, because people would
Alex
have put them back waiting
convinced.
For... Yeah, people would have put them back waiting for a time when a better time to be able to promote them.
If that was true, which I think it is true, is that a good thing for music, actually, to suddenly reduce the supply? Because one of the reasons you can't get people excited about it is just so much supply. But you take it away for a while, people start to get excited about it. You think there's anything in that?
I'm not sure there have been drastically less records that have been produced because artists haven't been touring, so they've been writing songs and recording them. But look at the Foo Fighters, for example. You know, they've just released a massive record because they haven't had anything else to do.
Is that selling? I guess it must be.
Well, it would be
not
selling.
Streaming.
That's it. Yeah. The paradigm's moved to streaming, hasn't it? And maybe this whole crypto thing is a sort of tacit rebellion against that because aren't, you know, at time they're not touring as well. So, you know, 100,000 streams wouldn't really matter to someone like Kings of Leon before, you know, where they had the touring ballast to make up the difference, but they don't at the moment.
No,
so I'm presuming their managers went, how do we make some decent cash out of this next record with our breadwinning activity out of the way?
Yeah.
Maybe this is it. So, I can't see how it's going to have legs for smaller artists. It's probably going to create between grassroots.
It won't still. But traditionally, big acts don't give a hoot about smaller artists.
Yeah.
Then they're not smaller artists anymore, so they don't care. That's basically how it works. Okay. So while we're also talking about general music business themes, who was it this week who said there are no groups anymore and caused great controversy by saying...
Oh, the guy from Maroon 5, was it?
Who are a group.
They are.
But he said in some interview, he said, it seems like when we started, there were loads of groups around, and nowadays there aren't. And as is traditional in this day and age, various people got out their prams and got very indignant about this, saying there are loads of groups around. And I think one of the first people to leap to the defence of the group community were the members of Garbage. You said, what about us? We're not chopped liver, you know. And I thought to myself, how long have Garbage been going? The answer is, Mark?
Well, I can remember their last great peak being around the end of the 90s, about 1997, I think. So they must be in the mid-90s. Yeah.
Okay, so they've been around 25 years. I don't think that really proves a great deal about whether there's still any groups nowadays, you know, because I think the point that guy was making was that the ones coming along nowadays were not bands. I mean, is that the case, Alex?
I think so. I think that by and large, people are moving away, young people are moving away from forming bands and creating their own music on their own because they have the means to do it.
Why would they form? Right now, in the last 18 months, would you have formed a band? And the easiest way to do it is to have as mobile a unit as possible, i.e. probably just you, and bring in whoever you wanted to help you record. I mean, the point about a band is to go out and perform live, isn't it? You don't need a band at the moment.
And if you think about checking the boxes as well, okay, you form a band to find your tribe. You know, you're 15 years old and you want to form a band. It's we've discussed this before, haven't we? It's not about the music at all. It's about, you know, something that's a bit more inherent than that to
it's
you
about
as a person.
The trousers.
It's about the trousers, the shoes, and the haircut. you know, finding your tribe. So you've got social media for that now. Everybody's connected to people all over the world in a completely different way. So that check. The other reason why you'd form a band is to get your name out there, to get your music out there. It was the only way that you could do that, by playing in front of people in places that you didn't live in. Again, you don't need to do that because the internet's sorted that out for you. It's in fact
the slowest way to get your name out nowadays is form a band, isn't it? You go on Twitter, you can get a name, can't you?
See, you couldn't play all the instruments. But you've got all these digital audio workstations now that are really comprehensive and really good at, you know, giving you the tools you need to be able to create fully fledged productions. That box is checked as well. So people, and D, you couldn't afford studio time. Logic, for example, costs, I think, about £200 for the whole program. And that box is checked as well. There is no real reason in 2021 to go out and form a band. It's just going to cause you logistical pain. And, you know.
Completely. I totally agree with you.
And you'd have to relinquish some of the control of your artistic vision on top of that as well. And, you know, if it's dear to you, why would you want to do that if you've got the option of cheaply and easily being able to hold on to it? So I think all of these things are kind of a perfect storm of factors that are coming together to lead people to do it on their own, because it's easier and they can. And so you're getting, you know, the Dua Lipas, the Grimeses, you know, the Lewis Capaldis, you know, who are their own entities, and that's becoming the thing. That's not saying bands don't exist,
but it's not the great dream it was it?
No, the best possible thing is solo artists. You can then get to appear on the whatever it is, the Graham Norton show, or whatever the key promotional opportunities are now. But I mean, no, band, you wouldn't be in a great rush to put a band together.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
All right, welcome back. Any other business? I'll tell you what, we recorded A Word in Your Attic with our old mate Bob Harris the other day. Which
was terribly good, wasn't it?
Which is terribly good.
And there's a very moving bit in it where Bob talks about losing, well, I guess it must be about 90% of his record collection, his vinyl collection, in a garage flood. Yeah. He lives up near Oxfordshire, and I guess the stream broke its banks and a great tide of mud kind of arrived and washed through his garage a few years ago. And just how mortifying it was to see all these records lost. And we're just thinking of the psychological repercussion of that happening. Terrible.
Well, he was dealing with it quite well, actually, to be fair.
He was?
I'll tell you what, I was, after that, it was such a good chat. And it started making me think about artists that I hadn't thought about in a while. And I'm sitting up here, I've got all this vinyl here, and I've got loads of CDs here. And I've got so many CDs that I'm in the happy position of forgetting what I've got.
Yeah.
Okay. Which after a long period, you're probably the same. I don't know. You're the same. And so I sit there thinking, have I got, I wonder if I've got so and so. And so then I started looking. And yesterday, I sat up here and I had the sport on one computer with the sound off, because there's nothing to be gained from the sound on live sport nowadays, because you can't hear the crowd. There's no excitement at all. It's the dullest thing. But you can't, it's there in the background. So I was doing that while playing music. And that led me think, have I got a Lonnie Donegan CD? Because Bob was enthusing. We were talking about Chris Barber and Lonnie Donegan. And so I got it. I found that I did. I have this, which is got a sticker describing it as, I'd never noticed this before, the thinking man's Lonnie Donegan. So it's obviously... this is a compilation of Lonnie Donegan without the corny stuff. You know what I mean? It doesn't have, does your chewing gum lose its flavor or anything like that?
Yeah.
And then I found this with the terrible cover. God, wonderful. This is a Drifters double CD of the greatest tunes of the lovely. Drifters, because Bob was enthusing about all those things. And I played the whole first CD, There Goes My Baby, and, you know, Mexican divorce and this magic moment and all these things. And I was thinking, what a glorious thing that was. This music was not made to be played loud. It's quite soft music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's no great thumping rhythm section there. And then, on the basis of having talked to Bob and also having talked to David Frick the day before, which terrific. Is already out there. David Frick was equally good. David Frick, the great American rock writer. He was, once again, he's got an early copy of Love's Forever Changes, which I've always said leaves me cold. Well, you'll be pleased to see that yesterday I actually played it and I quite liked it.
It's good.
So,
it's really good.
No, that's fair
enough. Yeah, Bob was a very significant moment in Bob's life, wasn't it, when he first met John Peel and he went round, John Peel invited him to come round. John Peel eventually got him onto Radio 1. He went round there and John Peel was doing a gig that night with Mark Bolan. Mark Bolan was sitting there in John Peel's house with an acoustic guitar playing the songs he was going to play at that gig that evening. And Peel gave him a copy of Love's Forever Changes, signed by him. That's a pretty momentous day, isn't it?
I suppose it is. No, but it's just interesting when you get to this stage with your record, you think, have I got that? And you go looking and you think, oh yes, you have.
That's great.
And that's a kind of even though you haven't played it for years, it's still there. You know, I did the same thing with do you know this record? Lewis Taylor's record.
I don't think I do, no.
Lewis Taylor, this is just about to be reissued on a double album, because when it originally came out, things hardly ever came out on vinyl.
Yeah.
And so Lewis Taylor is now the coolest, most hipsterish name you can possibly drop in English music. And this record did nothing at all. But it kind of thing that staggered me was that it's got the old promotional sticker on it. So it's got the name of the people from the promotions department at Ireland who put it out. And it came out on the 12th of August, 1996. That is 25 years.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely astonishing. Do you know this record, Alex?
I don't.
This guy. Oh, really? You should listen to it. It's on Spotify and so forth. It's he was the guy who, he's a genius, a musical genius. Could never quite write a hit, but immensely talented, and used to play in the Edgar Broughton band. Came from Barnet near me. And still, I think, works as kind of musical director for Gnarls Barkley. And that's regarded as the great undiscovered jewel of 90s popular music. And then he kind of walked away. He wasn't really interested in doing whatever was involved in being a pop star. But I couldn't get over the fact that it's 25 years ago.
And what's the name of the album again?
It's just called Lewis Taylor.
Lewis Taylor.
You look at the cover and you think, it wasn't helped by the fact that the cover looked like that, but in those days, CDs, nobody gave a hoot about what things looked like at the front. But 25 years later, it's like the point about garbage. I can't get over it, It's the length of people's memory nowadays for this stuff. It's far greater than it ever used to be in the past.
I still can't reconcile the fact that the Strokes aren't a new band anymore. Is This It was released 20 years ago, 2001, and I still feel like.
And also, like, the trouble with the Strokes, don't you think, a bit like the Beastie Boys, there are people who are sort of only kind of work as a young concept somehow. The Strokes, threatening, dangerous, disruptive. The idea that the Strokes are kind of moving into middle age doesn't quite work, really. I mean, lots of other bands have obviously managed it very successfully, but didn't seem to sort of sit with what the Strokes are fundamentally about.
No, it doesn't quite wash, does it? They're a bit paunchy around the edges now.
Beastie Boys is a classic example of that. Not that they're really still going, but the Beastie Boys, there was never a group more archetypally kind of two fingers, wasn't it?
My frat first party. Gig, the Beastie Boys.
Oh, my Lord, that's brilliant.
Beastie Boys, Bentley Rhythm Ace and Jungle Brothers in the Round Tour, great. Birmingham NEC. It was great. The six formers were there, and they bought a cider. It was a fantastic night.
So you weren't in the sixth form at that point?
No, I was definitely pre-sixth form.
Oh, really?
Yeah, by quite a bit. we were looked after. It was a great, great night, great gig.
Talking of first gigs, we ought to plug that again, that David Frick podcast, because his first gig, wasn't it a brilliant story, Dave? It was in 1968. Four groups on the bill. There was The Who, there was Procol Harum, there was The Troggs, and there was the Pink Floyd. Pretty amazing bill itself. Procol Harum didn't turn up because I can't remember. There was some kind of industrial dispute, or their gear wasn't allowed through. Troggs didn't turn up because they just didn't turn up because they were the Troggs. Pink Floyd went on and played, which is with Dave, first tour with David Gilmour in the band, played for 45 minutes. And then somebody got electrocuted on stage, not a member of the Pink Floyd, and The Who weren't allowed to play. So that was, for $1, that was his first gig. And he went with his dad, who sat very sweetly three rows behind him so as not to embarrass him. And he was sufficiently entranced by this incredible level of drama and chaos to embark on an entire life, basically, writing about rock music. It's a lovely story, wasn't it? Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah, so if you haven't caught up with that, that's David Frick.
Yeah.
You'll find it on the, on youtube.com/wordinyourear.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're a Patreon supporter, you would have been able to get full access to that early and in.
And there are some new Patreon supporters, Magic, aren't there?
There are indeed.
Come
this
on,
week,
give us the Hall of Fame.
Their names.
Well, welcoming aboard John Sills.
Hurrah!
John Sayles, hooray!
Claire Smith.
Very Claire good. Smith.
Trisha McNair.
Terrific, Trisha.
That's two women in a row. Good grief. They get a special award.
Patrick Butler.
Excellent. There we go. Good work from him.
Two annual patrons. If you subscribe annually, of course, you get a 15% discount. There's Joseph Hamilton and
Hello, Joseph.
Graham Robert Clark.
Very good. You also get a birthday visit from us.
Yep.
Which is a lot of fun to do. We've been doing some
wonderful. We shin down your digital drain pipe and we go through your possessions.
We rummage through your album collection and thoroughly enjoy it.
There must have been some new... Yeah, so we did one the other day with a Patreon supporter where the rest of us all look out of our windows and we see our back gardens in various unpromising suburban locations in the UK. This guy looks out. What does he see?
He sees
the Brooklyn Bridge.
His glorious sunshine, wasn't it? Wasn't it amazing? Oh, my God. I wouldn't be able to get anything done. I'd just sit and look out the window all day.
So when this bloody war is over, we're all going over there. We're just going to turn up at his front door.
We're going to crash at his pad.
Yeah,
and lower his scene.
If you want to join this merry throng, patreon.com/wordinyourear, where you can find out how you can get involved. And all the very best.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.